Welcome to the Arthroscopy Journal podcast. I'm Dr. Chris Tucker from the Walter Reed National Military Medical Center and the podcast editor. Today, we're discussing massive rotator cuff tears, and in particular, the biological superior capsule reconstruction, or bio-SCR, technique. It's really a privilege of mine to be joined in this discussion by Dr. Larry Field, Director of the Sports Medicine Fellowship at the Mississippi Sports Medicine and Orthopedic Center in Jackson, Mississippi, and past president of the Arthroscopy Association of North America. Dr. Field was a senior author on the recent article titled Augmentation of Massive Rotator Cuff Repairs Using Biceps Transposition Without Tenotomy Improves Clinical and Patient-Reported Outcomes, the Biological Superior Capsular Reconstruction Technique, published in the January 2024 issue of the Arthroscopy Journal. Larry, congrats on all your work and welcome to our podcast.
Thank you, Chris, very much for this opportunity to share our research.
Larry, the management of massive rotator cuff tears is difficult. And as any shoulder surgeon knows, given the wide spectrum of the surgical options available, the challenge in treating these patients lies in proper patient selection and in deciding what to do and when to do it. Recently, there's been this substantial attention paid to the idea of the superior capsule reconstruction. And in fact, we have covered it multiple times in previous podcasts over the last few years. Before we dive into the specifics of your article, could you just start us off giving us a little background on yourself, your interest in shoulder surgery, and your career path?
Yeah, sure. Thank you, Chris. I was raised and educated in Mississippi, medical school residency, and then did a sports medicine fellowship at the Hospital for Special Surgery in New York. And since I finished that fellowship, I've been back in Mississippi in practice for almost 30 years. I had the luxury and benefit of working with Dr. Buddy Savoy, who is my partner, for probably almost 15 years before he moved on to New Orleans and Tulane. So I benefited mightily from that. I learned a great deal from Buddy, and I've had the luxury of being able to do shoulder and elbow surgery throughout my career.
Well, given that perspective, I appreciate it. I always enjoy this opportunity to get to know our guests a little bit better with each interview. So with respect to the topic at hand, the management of patients with massive rotator cuff tears, and also in particular, your technique of the bio-SCR. Before we dive into the specifics of your technique, I wanted to first hear from your perspective, given you have such a substantial wealth of experience, can you just discuss for us the pathophysiology involved in massive rotator cuff tears and why they present such a challenge to all of us?
Of course, yes. You know, massive rotator cuff tears are, as you mentioned, certainly challenging to manage. These tears are, as we know, almost always chronic in nature and as such, very retracted and often immobile, which complicates our management. The detachment obviously leads to significant muscle atrophy and fatty infiltration. And these tears are often accompanied by some degree of reduced acromiohumeral interval distance as well, which is another complicating factor. It complicates our management, but ultimately, obviously, we really want to try to help these patients by eliminating their pain and hopefully improving their function.
So given the understanding of that uphill battle we're facing in managing these patients with the massive rotator cuff tear, could you just run through the various surgical management options we currently have at our disposal and how it is you approach your decision-making process when caring for these patients?
Oh, yeah, sure. That's a great question. You know, I guess importantly, non-operative treatments often very helpful and really, in fact, adequate in managing a number of these patients. But from a surgical perspective, our options include repairing the tear either completely or partially. And I would make a point that the literature is really replete with data that shows that there significant success can be achieved in patients, partial repairs done in properly selected patients. Jensen et al. Recently published an article that showed that non-healing of these rotator cuffs, even when they're not partial repairs, didn't necessarily correlate with functional outcomes. So I think that failure to heal completely doesn't necessarily translate into failure of the operation to help the patient. Other techniques other than repair would be to try to bridge the repair with some type of graft construct, more, I guess, of an interposition type of graft. And of course, we know about SCR. Another option is muscle transfer operations, such as the lower trapezius transfer. The balloon spacer is an option in some patients. And then obviously, a reverse shoulder arthroplasty. More recently, Kama, of course, we've been augmenting or supplementing these massive repairs with the biceps. One thing I would mention, though, you asked about decision-making. It's complicated to know what to do of all these options for patients. And, we know about a thorough history. We know about physical examination, and we know about objective testing. And all those are very, very important to helping us make an informed decision. Also, you know, as we know as well, the specifics of the patient, their age, activity level, what are they trying to get back to, are all very important. But I'd say that the great majority of patients, at least in our practice, that present with these massive tears can be very successfully managed with an arthroscopic repair.
I look forward to talking a little bit more about the specifics of your decision-making with respect to those options later on in the interview. So specifically speaking to the topic at hand, the biological SCR, could you just first run us through the procedure itself, which you yourself first published in Arthroscopy Techniques back in 2020, and then perhaps some of your own technical pearls for success?
Great. Yeah, absolutely. You know, the technique that we described and used in our article, in our study, was really quite simple to perform. In these massive tears, the biceps is very visible and it's easily accessible. And the only constraining structures for the biceps itself are in the bicipital groove. And so after, you know, intraoperatively, after we evaluate the rotator cuff, we debride it and we mobilize it using the techniques we're all familiar with, like interval slides and capsular releases and footprint medialization, which I would emphasize is, in my opinion, a very important concept of massive repair. Then we make an assessment about the repairability, quality of the tendon, et cetera. And at that time, we make a decision about whether or not to use the biceps. And so if we're going to use the biceps for this particular technique, then we completely mobilize the biceps all out of the groove and we debride and release the transverse humeral ligament all the way down until there's no more bicipital groove restraints. And then we just simply use a grasper to grasp the biceps, and then we move the intact biceps. We transpose it, if you will, to a new position on the greater tuberosity. Now, one thing that we used as an exclusion criteria in our study was those patients that have maintained an intact anterior cable. That is, they have a massive tear, but that anterior cable remains intact, which we see occasionally. Those patients were contraindications for us because we really didn't, it's hard to move the biceps using the technique that we want to use without releasing that anterior cable, and we didn't feel that that was valuable or appropriate for these patients. These patients in the study were repairable. We placed the biceps really in the central part of the greater tuberosity. We repaired the cuff over the top of that. If the tear was only partially repairable, we typically moved the biceps to wherever the residual tissue void was going to be. You know, we grab the different elements of the tear, we see what the repairability is, and if there's a partial repair-only option, we would place the biceps into that void. Typically, that void was near the greater tuberosity anterior posteriorly anyway. We then secured the biceps in whatever location we chose using standard suture anchors. Also, once it's secured, you know, one thing that we tried to emphasize in our publication was that we found that it's a very, very valuable convergence post. You know, remember that in this technique, where we simply move the biceps to this greater tuberosity and we don't cut the biceps loose, either proximally or distally, we maintain that physiologic tensioning, or even one could argue super physiologic tensioning. And those convergent sutures, we can attach, we can pass through it, we can use it to offload our rotator cuff repair construct. Also, another important point about this biceps is that it's very thick as a graft. You know, it averages 6.5 millimeters in diameter as it exits the bicipital groove. And Pat Dennard and his group helped us to understand that. And that's a really thick graft. If you're trying to reproduce the super capsule, for example, that 6.5 millimeters is thicker than most reported grafts for super capsule reconstruction. And finally, one other point I'd make here on this technique is for the purposes of the study, we did not make intraoperative determinations about whether or not to use the biceps based on the status of the biceps. For example, if the biceps were significantly frayed but otherwise intact, if we wanted or needed to use it, then we used it irrespective of its status, whether it was fraying or whatever. The feeling like in the situations that we used it in for the study, that to augment using diseased tissue was probably better than not using tissue at all. So that, at least that was our assumption.
Yeah, that's a great summary of the technique and your rationale for doing it. Just a quick follow-up on the technique itself. I know you have a video associated with the arthroscopy technique publication back in 2020, but just for those who haven't seen it or who are listening in their car right now, what are your tips for actually doing that complete release of the biceps out of the inner tubercular groove? Are you viewing from subacromial? Are you using a 30 or a 70 degree scope? How are you making sure you get it completely released, which I don't think is a technique many people are probably doing routinely in shoulder arthroscopy right now outside of this sort of technique?
Yeah. Okay. That's great. We believe and try to always use that 50 yard line view to do our rotator cuff repairs, you know, that straight lateral portal access site. We think we can see under the cuff better. We think we can incorporate the super capsule and standard regular rotator cuff tears better. And so we use that standard lateral portal site to visualize the bicipital groove. Remember, again, this is a massive tear, and you can see the biceps exiting into the bicipital groove. And with some degree of external rotation, let's say 20 or 30 degrees, you can usually bring that bicipital groove into full view. And then I typically just use a standard arthroscopic shaver, just a synovectomy type shaver. Right at the top of the groove, I engage that transverse humeral ligament, and I just, under direct visualization, just debride right down through the groove and all the way down. You really can typically see it without much difficulty all the way down until there are no more constraints on the biceps, because that allows us to then move the entire biceps without it remaining constrained in the bicipital groove, which we always have felt like that increases the length of the biceps that has to pass across even greater than just moving it to the tuberosity without constraint.
Yeah, that's a great tip. One follow-up, more of a conceptual question. I know you mentioned your thoughts on why this seems to add to the benefit of the massive cuff repair. What are you thinking the best benefit of it is? Do you think it's that static depressive effect of just having the biceps tissue in the subacromial space, kind of like the SCR thickness or the balloon? Do you think it's more of the dynamic humeral head depression by leaving that muscular, you know, tendon muscular unit intact? Do you think it's a biological additive effect on the cuff healing? I mean, obviously, it's probably all the above, but where are you in your experience doing so many of these, thinking you're seeing the kind of the most benefit from it?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I do think it's all of the above. You know, we believe the humeral head is stabilized to some extent by securing the biceps to the greater tuberosity. I think it provides, probably, we can't prove it. We did a clinical study, right? Just a case series. I think we believe it probably provides a static depressive effect. Also, we have hypothesized that this otherwise intact long head biceps that's been transposed may allow for a dynamic humeral head depressive force, since, you know, the biceps contracts around the same time as the cuff. You know, we know that a lot of these massive tears have some degree of decreased acromiohumeral interval distance. And so maybe there's some type of protective or valued effect as a consequence. Also, the biceps itself, as I mentioned earlier, provides, I think, really significant improved biomechanical strength of the repair itself, because it's this really stout, physiologically tensioned tendon that we can sew to and converge with. It also, in our study, reduced the necessity for anchors, the total number of anchors, because we just could often tie to it. And lastly, remember from a biological standpoint that because we don't cut it, either proximally or distally, it's still alive. It's still in immediate proximity, and it's not been devascularized by a tenotomy on either end.
Yeah, I think it's a really exciting idea, very novel concept, and excited to hear more about it. So let's jump into your case series in this particular paper. You reported on 30 consecutive patients in whom you performed the bio-SCR. They had an average age of 67 years, and you followed them for an average of just under 3 years with both pre- and post-operative ASES scores, pain scores, strength, and range of motion measurements. Could you just tell us about your experience with this series and what were your key findings?
Yeah, absolutely. Sure. You know, we report on our first 30 consecutive patients. The first one we did, we included it and we did the first 30 and then reported on our outcomes for that group of patients. Our key findings were the fact that the ASES scores improved statistically significantly over the entire period of the study. Also, a patient's active forward flexion improved from 120 degrees to 157 degrees postoperatively, which was significant. And none of the patients in our study lost motion. Also, I think it's important here to recognize that these patients were not these pseudo-paralytic patients, because remember, they're preoperative motion, active forward flexion was 120 degrees. And I think it's hopefully representative, demonstrating the type of patients that we decided to operate on and do arthroscopic repair on. Also, our pain scores decreased significantly in these study patients. And that was basically the key findings that we had.
Yeah, I think it's pretty remarkable. I mean, you described well, you know, the patient who has pretty preserved motion, but really significant pain. Your preoperative average VAS pain score was over 7. And then postoperatively, you got them all on average under 1. The average postoperative pain score was 0.9. That's a pretty remarkable improvement in pain, which was durable all the way out 2 years. And then you also described one complication. It was a proximal biceps rupture in 1 out of the 30. You didn't mention, at least I didn't catch anywhere in there, if you described anybody who had subclinical or mild biceps symptoms postoperatively. What was your experience with that in particular? Were these folks complaining of any sort of biceps symptoms with active motion and such?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we were quite sensitive to this issue, you know, because we were concerned about doing this. We hadn't, you know, we just started doing it. And we worried, that's one of the things we worried about. And so we carefully followed these patients and really had no patients that we could attribute. Now, granted, it's difficult to localize that or quantify that, but no patients that we could identify that we felt like had demonstrable biceps-related pain that occurred postoperatively.
Yeah, that's really remarkable. So I wanted to discuss, with respect to the pre-op superior humeral head migration or glenohumeral arthritis, you stated neither of those were exclusion criteria in and of themselves, but you believe that they had a high likelihood of benefiting from a rotator cuff repair. I'm just curious to hear how you make that determination preoperatively. As we know, both of those can be prognostic factors for determining rotator cuff repair outcomes in general. But in your series, you had a distribution of patients with osteoarthritis classified Hamada stage 1 all the way through 4A. Is this just an experience thing for you? If so, can you just share some of that insight with us on how you're looking at these patients in the office and saying who's a good one for a cuff repair and who just needs to go to a debridement or a reverse?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's really the $64,000 question. I mean, we know when we interact and we examine these patients with massive cuff tears, there's quite the gestalt, if you will, to making decisions about who might benefit from a massive repair. You know, I can just talk about, for me, you know, factors that drive my decision making are first, obviously, that every patient has to be individualized. I just don't think there's a template that we can use, because there's a lot of variability in their function, their pain, their activity level, et cetera. But deal breakers for me for rotator cuff repair consideration are, of course, advanced arthritis plus massive cuff tears. Those patients need to be treated either non-operatively or with a reverse shoulder, or maybe a balloon in certain clinical situations. Also, you know, longstanding acromohemoral interval measures of, you know, 3 millimeters or less are probably not good candidates for repair. A paper by Chung et al., I remember, showed that if you had an AHI of less than 4 millimeters, 1 millimeter, 2 millimeters, 3 millimeters, it correlated with poor outcomes. The average AHI in the patients in our study was 5.5 millimeters. You know, and I'll just go on and say that for me personally, in making these decisions about who gets a rotator cuff repair and who doesn't, you know, I think for me, the first and most important thing is the history. A lot of these patients present, they clearly have had a rotator cuff tear for a very long time, but they present for a reason. Why is it? You know, did something happen to them? You know, what is it that makes them present? So the history is quite important. What was their function before they presented, et cetera? Second, the physical examination, extremely important, as we all know. And I use the radiographs because those include those deal breakers, those AHIs, those arthritis patients. And lastly, the MRI, although it's, of course, very valuable.
Also interesting to me in your paper was you stated the bio-SCR was actually used pretty sparingly during this study period. Even in the most challenging cases, you reported only around 15% of the massive tears were indicated for using this bio-SCR. Could you just qualify that for us a little better? Talk us through your intraoperative decision-making on just what exactly you were looking for to say when this was appropriate. Obviously, your patient selection was likely critical to your very favorable outcomes. So just trying to see if we can replicate that on a larger scale for other surgeons. What is it you were doing intraop to say, yes, you fit into that 15% of these massive tears that would benefit?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm glad you asked that. I think it's an important one. It gets back to our indications to do this operation when we first started doing it. So when we first started doing this procedure, this bio-SCR procedure, we were concerned, obviously, that there could be some unrecognized problems associated with transposing the biceps using this specific technique, and were concerned about the possibility that somehow we would constrain motion, cause motion loss by the transfer itself. We also were worried about the possibility that the transposition could cause, as we mentioned earlier, the potential for significant postoperative biceps pain. And so for that reason, we really reserve utilization of the biceps in this technique for the most challenging cases where there was really a lot of atrophy or retraction, or we really were challenged to get it fixed. You know, we were, I guess, maybe arguably relatively desperate to try to achieve a functional repair, and so maybe more inclined to add the biceps to the mix intraoperatively. And for that reason, we only used it sparingly early on as a kind of a proof of concept for us. And we, in the paper, we estimated that over the period of the study, I'd done about 300 massive cuff tears. And we assumed, again, that 2/3 of those may have probably had an intact bicep. So if you do the math, 30 into 200 is 15%. So that's really how we came to that number. It was just we used it for more challenging cases. I would say, though, that subsequent to the end of that data collection, we've used it much more liberally. And I estimate probably that we've used the bio-SCR technique about 100 times in the last year and a half or so. And other surgeons have communicated to me that they've been using it some too. So I suspect it's being used much more commonly currently.
One other general topic related to your paper I wanted to ask you was regarding the preoperative MRI. I know we mentioned earlier a lot of these retracted massive cuff tears have fatty atrophy. You've mentioned a few times that you rely on x-rays a lot, the acromiohumeral distance and such. I was just wondering, I didn't see in the paper any mention of the Guttallier classification for fatty atrophy. Was that looked at or controlled for, or did that correlate with any of your repairability factors or any outcomes?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, no, we didn't really formally correlate repairability or the outcomes with fatty infiltration. We looked at it. We use it as a factor preoperatively to help maybe sometimes make decisions about whether or not we were going to engage in arthroscopic repair. But for us, it really honestly plays a relatively minor role, trumped by the history, the physical examination, et cetera. when we compare it to other factors that I've mentioned earlier.
As we know, rotator cuff tears and related surgery still remains one of the most studied topics in all of orthopedics, with obviously a lot of continued advancement in the field with papers such as yours. What do you think is currently the most exciting area of investigation, or what do you see as the most important unanswered question right now in the area of rotator cuff repair research?
Yeah, that's great. You know, there's a lot of interesting areas of ongoing research related to this common, but, you know, still surprisingly quite challenging problem we deal with all day, every day, you know, and there's lots of investigation into biologics, which is exciting. It comes to mind. And ultimately, I think probably inevitably, there'll be some biologic augments or methods to improve healing and functionality of these cuff tears. They're on the way. It's a complex area of research, but I'm confident that one day, there'll be implants, injectables, maybe structural augments that will ultimately improve outcomes. Some are still over the horizon, and they'll probably get here like they've kind of been getting here in the last few years, you know, maybe baby steps, you know. And I think about cancer treatment, you know, there's no magic bullet. Cancer treatments is kind of a one-off, maybe little by little. I think there's not going to be a magic bullet for rotator cuff repair either, but hopefully these investigations, industry support, et cetera, will help us ultimately be able to really improve the care of our patients with these tears using biologic supplementation.
I agree. That's quite exciting. And as you mentioned earlier, I think a huge take-home point is to treat each patient as an individual. And I don't think, as you said, there's any algorithmic or cookie-cutter approach to many things, but particularly the rotator cuff, especially the massive cuff tear, because like you said, there's just so many patient-specific factors that contribute to the outcomes and the treatment that everybody has to really be treated as an individual. So Larry, right, as you've said, you've provided us a really nice summary of the management of massive rotator cuff tears and the biological superior capsule reconstruction. Do you have any other closing remarks you want to share with us before we wrap up our episode?
No, Chris, I just want to thank you for your efforts and for the excellent work that you do and that the Arthroscopy Journal does to support this podcast and the opportunity to report on our research. I also just want to thank my wonderful co-authors on this project, Drs. Gray McClatchy, one of our previous fellows, Doug Purcell, and Dr. Rhett Hobgood, my partner, for their, you know, invaluable support and assistance with the project.
Well, I certainly want to congratulate you and your co-authors again on this work, and for you in particular on all you've contributed to the field of orthopedics, sports medicine, and ANA in general. It's really a privilege for me to be able to interview folks like yourself, past president, leader in our association, and in orthopedic sports medicine. So thanks for sharing your time and your thoughts with us today, Larry.
Thank you, Chris, very much.
Dr. Field's article titled "Augmentation of Massive Rotator Cuff Repairs Using Biceps Transposition Without Tenotomy Improves Clinical and Patient-Reported Outcomes, the Biological Superior Capsular Reconstruction Technique," is available in the January 2024 issue of the Arthroscopy Journal, which is available online at www.arthroscopyjournal.org. This concludes this edition of the Arthroscopy Journal podcast. The views expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent the views of the Arthroscopy Association or the Arthroscopy Journal. Thank you for listening. Please join us again next time.